Welcome to Dear Instructional Designer, Episode 6. Hey everyone, welcome back to Dear Instructional Designer, the show about the instructional design journey. I'm your host, Kristen Anthony. Today we've got our first interview and our guest is Brian Washburn, instructional designer extraordinaire. I first met Brian via Twitter. You might have seen him around. He's at Flipchart Guy. And one of the things that Brian is really great at is exploring learning and development as an organization and asking us as IDs to question the way we're doing things and the way we're interacting with others within our organizations. He's got a lot of great and practical advice to share on how we can get better at helping others to do their jobs better. Without further ado, here's the first part of my interview with Brian. All right, so Brian, why don't you introduce yourself for us?
Sure. I'm Brian Washburn. I am currently the Learning and Development Director for an organization called SightLife, which is an eye bank, as in cornea transplants. And in terms of my background with learning and development, I've been in the learning and development space for about 18 years in some way, shape, or form, starting as a Peace Corps volunteer, working with farmers and cooperatives in Paraguay, making my way through a role as a GED instructor in a youth center in Washington, D.C. And then I started to get more formal internal training positions starting in Washington, D.C. And then I moved out to Seattle, where I was the training director for a national nonprofit organization that worked in foster care for a number of years. And now here I am at SightLife as the learning and development director for the organization's learning initiatives. So in some small way, not only do I change the world through learning and development initiatives, but I also help to cure blindness. So it's a pretty cool combination.
Yeah. I mean, so many people seem to just sort of fall into instructional design. Do you feel like that happened for you?
Absolutely. Growing up as the son of a teacher, I had always wanted to avoid education like the plague, right? So I grew up and so I watched my father, and he seemed to really enjoy what he did, but he didn't have summers off like you would think the teachers have off. So he would paint houses and do other things. That wasn't the life that I wanted. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to run away from that. And then coming back from my experience in the Peace Corps in 2000, I ended up in a role as an instructor in a classroom teaching GED classes. And so it seemed to be my destiny. It was almost like Darth Vader calling me back. And so my father really was my first mentor when it came to how did I get into instructional design and what did instructional design mean. He never used those terms, but to be able to create engaging lessons, he was the person who really was the one who taught me, this is what you actually need to do in order to engage people. You don't just talk at them, you don't just give them content, but you need to give them the why and what's in it for them and things like that. So I did just kind of fall into it after kind of a circuitous route after college. I graduated undergrad as a political science major, and what do you do with that? And so I kind of jumped around from position to position, job to job for a while, and just kind of ended up in that role of instructional designer at some point.
Yeah, cool. Well, I mean, so you talked a little bit about this, you know, being able to say that what you're doing has a direct impact on curing blindness. What would you say were some of the other best parts of your particular position?
So one of the coolest things, I think, of anybody who's in a role of instructional design and learning and development, and especially anybody who works for an organization that gives them a relatively long leash, is that I can be as creative as I want to be as long as I'm also as effective as the organization needs me to be. Mm-hmm. And so having sat through a number of conference sessions and training programs that have been mind-numbingly boring. One of the coolest things that I get to do is I get to be super creative, and I get to watch people engage in the content and learn new skills or new knowledge or new ways about doing things that people otherwise wouldn't have had the opportunity to do had we not gotten creative. And so people not only learn things, but they learn it and they enjoy doing it at the same time. And some of it goes, I'm able to draw back on my undergrad experience, not necessarily in the content of what I did, but I was also the mascot at the George Washington University, which was another outlet or one of the initial outlets for my creativity. And being able to bring that element of my personality into something that I get paid to do is pretty fun.
Yeah, that's really cool. You know, I feel like in my journey, I've been really fortunate to work with a lot of people who give me support to be creative. But I know that a lot of other instructional designers sort of feel very constricted in certain ways. How would you say you sort of evolve to push your creativity or to get other people to let you be creative? Like, has that? Yeah,
it's a great question, and excuse me. So, working right now in the healthcare field, where when you go to and a lot of medical education is very dry. And so I have done presentations for the iBank Association of America annual conference in the past, and it's been received to mixed reviews. Some people really like that creativity. For other people, it's a little bit too far of a leap from what they're comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it's all part of calibration to who is the audience and how far would they be willing to go, stretching them beyond their comfort zone, but not into a zone in which it's just totally so uncomfortable, an environment that so totally creates a panic in the learners that they can't learn. So so there definitely is, there are some boundaries that you want to be able to kind of get a feel for the audience and what people are going to be willing to humor you with versus what's going to just kind of make people super anxious and that will then get in the way of learning. So the other piece that's a little bit on one end constricting to what I do and the other end kind of necessitates creativity is that a lot of the work that I do will be done in India, where there's sometimes a language barrier. And so by needing to get people to engage in more activities, not only is it good instructional design practice, it's also something that I need to do because of language barriers. And that goes back to some stuff that that I read in a book from Jane Vella called Learning to Listen, Learning to Teach. And it's all about dialogue education. And she came up with these 12 principles of dialogue education that seemed to her to work regardless of context, regardless of culture. And so when people say, well, it's different here, or you can't do that in a place like India, going back to these principles that have been proven effective all across the world with people who have high levels of education, low levels, different socioeconomic backgrounds, or even different professional backgrounds or contexts, all of these principles seem to work. And so so part of it is being able to judge your audience and how far it might be too far. But the other part is just being able to stick to your guns and kind of be bold in the way that you want to continue to push the envelope.
Yeah, I think it's really important that you brought it back to the audience. I know I just went through some alpha testing, and there was one lady in particular who was like, I want my e-learning to be video quiz, you know, and on the one hand, I'm like, that's not really a good enough reason for that to remain that way just because you're used to it. But at the same time, I saw that, you know, patterns and setting up expectations for patterns was really important. So that, yeah, I think that's really helpful for everybody to say, you know, to make it not about them.
Yeah, in the end, it does. It always has to come back to the audience.
Yeah.
And I need to remind myself of that when I think, oh, I could do this awesome creative idea,
right, yeah.
And then realize it's not necessarily what they need. It may be what I want, but it's not what they need. So being able to rein it back in and always go back to that question: what's in it for the audience, or what does the audience need, as opposed to what do I want to do or tell, is key.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Brian, you're in healthcare. I know there are instructional designers basically in every field, and they're all so different. What would you say were some of the things that were sort of unique about the context of healthcare?
Yeah, so healthcare, some of the things that I've found unique, and now maybe other people who are listening to this would from industries that I'm not familiar with would say, well, that's similar to my industry as well. But some of the things that I found unique as I came into this space is that a lot of times when we're working with doctors, for example, these are really high-powered, successful people who like to have things done their way, because when they're in the operating room, if things aren't done their way, it could be the difference between life and death. Mm-hmm. And so working in that type of context where you're sometimes working with people who are used to having it their way all the time, has been something that I'm still getting used to, because there's a difference between the operating room and the training room. Mm-hmm. And so having somebody who comes in and says, well, my way is the difference between life and death in general. I'm going to just bestow my wonderful information upon people. And they should be really appreciative of getting this information, and working with subject matter experts like that, who are coming from that point of view, to get them to be more engaging and really embrace some of these principles of adult learning has been a unique challenge that I've found in the medical field. Another thing that's a little bit different from the standpoint of being in this field, not just medical field, but also global health, has been that, and specifically with iBanking, is that there are a ton of metrics that we have that, in other places where I've worked, and my background has been primarily the nonprofit sector, foster care, for example, you don't know what the results are of that work for. It could be a year, it could be decade until you actually see the results of that work. And so, being in this particular field, the medical sector, global health, and then specifically iBanking or organ donation, which is very time sensitive, there are a ton of metrics that we have that we can take advantage of to be able to measure are some of the things that we're doing actually quantitative or quantifiable for us to see are things working, and if they're not, how do we tweak them to continue to work.
That's really cool. Yeah, I feel like particularly in my last position, but a little bit in this one too, that it's, you know, we're kind of just sort of sending our ships out into the water, and whether or not we're being effective is, I'm not sure that we're actually looking at that very closely. What would you say are sort of the, how are you guys doing that, and what would you say are the advantages of doing that? And then just, you know, you, like you said, you guys have a lot of metrics, but other people don't. How would you sort of advise people who maybe don't have real good metrics to go on about whether or not they're being effective? Sorry,
yeah.
That was a lot. Yeah.
No, it's a great question. And that, to me, is one of the core struggles of anybody in learning development. Mm-hmm. How do we prove our value, right?
Yeah.
And so one of the cool things that I was able to work on at the end of last year, beginning of this year, was actually writing an article for TD Magazine, which came out this month, that actually was able to make the connection between adding an additional 0.5 FTE to training, and training positions are generally perceived as a net drain on resources. So we're able to take a look and see what is the actual direct connection between increasing our training headcount by a half a person, half a full-time person, is there a connection to how well the training program improved? And then is there a connection between how much faster people are picking up their skills? And then, you know, is there a financial result of that? And we're able to show that just with a 0.5 increase in training headcount, there was a 10 times return on the financial performance of the organization because people were competent more quickly and were actually effective in their jobs more quickly. Mm-hmm. And so that's one specific metric that a lot of people like to be able to look at. What is the bottom line for our training department? Mm-hmm. Are they net contributing or net drain? And so at SiteLife, where we have tons of time-based metrics, it's a little bit easier. But even for organizations or even at SiteLife, when we do soft skills-based training, leadership development, we continue to try to figure out, okay, well, if we're going to do this, what's the problem we're looking to address? We want to, and maybe it's not necessarily a hardcore business metric like time to competence or things like that, but can we impact our annual survey results when it comes to I have the tools that I need in order to do the job that I'm asked to do? Or can we take a look at, is there a connection between some type of management training and organizational retention? So we're constantly trying to figure out what are the problems that we're looking to solve and how do we know that they're actually problems? Mm-hmm. And so having the luxury of a metric, an organization where there are so many metrics available, it's part of the culture. And so even when it's not a time-based metric for operations, we're constantly on the lookout for, okay, well, what metric is there that we'd be able to touch upon? Now, sometimes you're not going to have a metric, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't always be looking for one. Mm-hmm. We can't use that as learning professionals in general. We can't use that as our excuse. Oh, it's hard, or it's a soft skill, so it's not measurable. I think that even with soft skills, there are business needs that we're looking to address.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What was I going to ask? Oh, so would you recommend, say, somebody who's, so you're in a high level position, so somebody who's just, you know, your instructional designer on the ground. How would you recommend they sort of push towards this kind of thing or try and do it themselves so that they can show their value?
Yeah. Excuse me. One of the key things that I think that anybody in instructional design needs to have their arms around, and for those who are just breaking into the field of instructional design, it may even be more important. So instructional designers, by nature, we want to create a good experience for the learners. At the same time, in order to create a good experience for the organization, what we need to be constantly asking ourselves is, why are we doing this? What's going to be the impact? What's the need? And by being able to ask those questions, so I think that instructional designers need to have some good sound principles around instructional design, right? Needs assessment, things like that. Mm-hmm. But they also need to know the business and be able to speak the business language. And this gets into, you and I were talking a little bit before about jargon. We want to get, you know, we have kind of these neat terms, level one evaluation or things like that. We want to get away from using the terms of our own craft mm-hmm. and trade. And I think that in order to be successful and actually to have people have confidence in you, instructional designers need to adopt the language of the organizations in which they work mm-hmm. and also be aware of what the business needs are in their organizations. So high-level strategy, but also specific business needs of units that they may be working with or their internal clients that they may be working with. So instructional designers not just need that instructional design and how do you create a lesson plan and things like that, but also consulting skills. How do I partner with these clients in order to make sure that they are getting what they really need as opposed to perhaps what they want upon first request? Mm-hmm. So starting to ask some questions can sometimes help the client realize, well, maybe actually a training isn't what I need. Maybe it's a job aid or things like that. So being able to ask questions, being able to ask questions and almost rule out training as the first or only solution is going to be a key skill set to develop for newer instructional designers.
Yeah. And so the two things that you touched on there were two things that I actually am experiencing currently. Like I like to talk a lot about action mapping, Kathy Moore's action mapping. And then when I came here into the academic space, they talk about backwards design, which I think is really similar to action mapping, but it just seemed like really important to use this new language. It's very unfamiliar to me, but it just seemed like I need to be using this language, so that is really important. And I'm glad you said that. And then the other thing was, you were talking about these consulting skills, which is really, really, really difficult, particularly when you're dealing with somebody who is maybe very resistant. And so what is your model or process for a kickoff or a collaboration, and why does that work for you? Like, how do you deal with this consulting issue that we all have to deal with?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So one of the first things that I do anytime that somebody asks, hey, can you help me with this training program, is I want to make clear that they are the experts in the subject matter. And so all I'm trying to do is help other people understand it better. That said, the client or the key stakeholder is going to be the person who needs to really call the shots. Now, I'm here to help. Mm-hmm. And so the first question that I ask, so I'll give you a specific example. Recently, I was asked by the director of another department, hey, can you help us overhaul our new employee training for new employees for this technical skill? And so I said, okay, yeah, why don't we talk about that a little bit? And so what did you have in mind? And they started to tell me that the program that they had, you know, it's been around for a long time, but it could probably improve by incorporating some principles of adult learning. And I almost felt like that was their attempt at buttering me up, because they knew that I'm a champion for adult learning, right? Yeah. And so I said, well, how do you think that adult learning is going to, integrating additional principles are going to help with this program? And they said, you know, really what we're looking to do is to make sure that people are able to retain this information better. What's happening right now is they come here for a week of training, then they go back out into the field where they're working, and they're able to do some of the technical stuff well, but then they forget to do something. So that either leads to a phone call to me or a form that's not filled out correctly or whatever it might be. So we want to reduce the number of errors that people are making on things that they should have learned when they were here for a week. And that made a ton more sense. Maybe it was adult learning that needed to be incorporated, or maybe it was a checklist or a job aid or something else. But By starting to ask some of these questions, and this is the process that I start to use, I don't want to just say, okay, yeah, because it would have been easy to say, okay, give me what you have. I'll put together something that has a little bit more adult learning and it's a little bit less lecture-based and more activity-based, and great would be great. That wasn't the problem they were actually trying to address, though. And so by continuing to ask questions and starting to dig, it's almost like the lean principle of five whys, right? You ask why, and then somebody gives you a response, and then you ask why again, and until you can't ask why anymore, in order to make sure that you're getting to the right problem. And that is super important in order to demonstrate your value to the organization, making sure that you're solving the right problem, mm-hmm. as opposed to just giving the solution that people come with without asking any questions.
Great, great stuff from Brian. Please, if you've got a moment, definitely check out Brian's blog, trainlikeachampion.wordpress.com. And also contact him on Twitter @flipchartguy and show him some love for sharing his experience with us. Last, feel free to start up a conversation with us. I'm at AnthChris, and I'd love to know if you have any follow-up questions for Brian after this short part of our conversation. We'd love to hear from you. Next week, we'll be back with the second part of our conversation. I'll talk with you soon. Take care.